Hello and welcome to Housefeld's Collective Cast. I'm here with Anthony Mason, Nicola Boyle and David Lorne. And today we're going to be looking at certification. It feels a very good point to do so. We're going to be looking at what we've learned to date about certification, what tactics defendants are taking to defeat certification or not, as the case may be, which areas are still battlegrounds, what are the key points that are being fought over, and then we're going to have a look to the future as well. So Anthony, the regime, we're almost more than actually now 7 years since the regime was introduced. We spent a while in the deep freeze, but now everything's taken off.
We did, didn't we? Amazing to think that in the first 3 to 4 years we had a couple of cases. Merricks took a long time to take off, but we're now in the position where we've got 27 claims filed, if you count some of the FX and interchange and the like. 10 of them certified, and a whole range in terms of a lot of big tech claims, obviously, but we're now seeing claims in other regulated sectors, and also recently in crypto. And if you listen to what people are talking about in the market, there's clearly plenty more to come behind that 27 as well.
Yeah. Very good. And so if we start with what we've learned then about certification, so there was this wider question, wasn't there? This wider question, I guess, as to where the UK regime was going to pitch itself at certification, relative to the US regime, the Canadian regime, other regimes in other jurisdictions. And I think that was, you know, notwithstanding the legislation, there was some debate about that. And that question, I think, in large part has been answered by the Supreme Court's decision in Merricks. And of course, Lord Briggs, the leading judgment in that case, made very clear that certification isn't a merits test. So the only hurdles are those listed at Section 47B5 and 6 of the Competition Act, and then Rule 79(1). And that is to say, as we know, the tribunal must authorise the representative, and then the underlying claims must be eligible for inclusion in collective proceedings. There was also, of course, this really interesting part of Lord Briggs' judgment where he talked about suitability, defined suitability. That received a lot of comment at the time, and he said that suitability is a relative assessment. And then he also talked about this multifactorial balancing exercise with the factors at Rule 79(2). So I mentioned those two criteria, Nicola, the authorisation criteria and the eligibility criteria. Do you want to talk about the first of those?
Yes, so thanks, Lucy. The authorisation criteria is authorising the class representative as suitable to bring the claim. And we've seen a number of challenges in the early cases, perhaps defendants not unexpectedly trying to test the boundaries on that. They're not going, though, to the suitability of the reps themselves, who I think generally have been all found to be very credible and working in the best interests of the regime. Instead, they've been testing the boundaries, I think, of the funding and insurance elements, mm-hmm. the ability of the class rep to show that they've got the funds to bring the claim and, of course, to cover the defendant's costs. I think what we've seen from that, though, is although various challenges have been brought to the level of funding, the availability of funding, the terms of the funding, we've seen the tribunal being fairly robust, I think, mm-hmm. and resolving those issues relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. In the first cases, we saw these issues being raised. I think more latterly now, it's really settled down. It's mm-hmm. it's quite clear what the tribunal will accept in terms of the terms and what's being put forward. And I think underlying that, there's a recognition that the funding is an essential part of bringing the claim.
Yeah.
And the tribunal really has grasped that and pushed back quite firmly, I think, on saying, yes, this is, you know, something which we're going to have to accept in order for the claims to progress. So I think going forwards, that is one element where we hope now those challenges will have run their early battlegrounds, mm. and we will see that sort of allowing cases to progress much more quickly on the authorisation criteria.
Mm. And I think a pragmatic approach from the tribunal, right, in the sense of allowing claimants to go away and, you know, amend one line in an LFA or a policy, it seems a really sensible approach.
Exactly, and particularly in the early cases where you know people were pioneering and working out how the tribunal wanted to approach this. So as you say, quite pragmatic, not throwing out the baby with the bathwater, but allowing people to come back and make sure that it is suitable.
Mm-hmm. And so that's the authorisation criteria. On the eligibility criteria, now one of the key, I think, points of challenge in this area has been to the claimant's methodology, and we've seen quite a few challenges, haven't we?
Yeah, this is really where the focus has been, I think, and trying to understand what is the test. Is it a merits test? Is it not a merits test? And I think it's now firmly established it is not a test on the merits. It's open to a defendant to bring a strikeout. We've seen a couple of those sought, but that is where the merits challenge sits, on a strikeout test. Otherwise, the eligibility is really saying, is there a methodology which establishes that is capable of being used to establish class-wide harm? And again, we see some pragmatism, I think, coming in here from the tribunal, acknowledging that at this stage the claimant has maybe no data available or what's only in the public domain, so they're not being asked to exactly identify that, have it available, but show where they will be able to get it from in due course to support their methodology. We've seen some tests around the edges of this, and we've seen the tribunal, I think, trying to work out how to approach the question. Do you need both experts in a hot tub, as we saw in Qualcomm? Do you just need the claimant's expert, relying on the tribunal's expertise to test what is being said? And I think practically we've seen the tribunal quite being pragmatic. It's not whether there is a better methodology, but is the methodology that's being put forward one that they think is sensible, grounded in the facts, and that there will be data available in due course. I think we'll carry on seeing some challenges on this front. I suspect they won't slow down, Anthony.
No, I think that's right. But it's been refreshing, hasn't it, to see that underpinning this approach is this right to quantification based on the best data available. I mean, we've waited a long time for the broad axe to be wielded in the competition claim context. But Briggs in Merrick is very clear about it. And then we saw the Court of Appeal in Trains taking the broad axe, arguably adjusting the axe head, but nonetheless using the axe very widely. And I just think it's very refreshing.
And it is refreshing where the answer is, otherwise, if the data's not there, do the claims just fail?
Yeah.
And that can't be right. You go back to 2009 when people said you couldn't bring these claims at all. That's now accepted, but it's as acknowledged by the Court of Appeal and Supreme Court, you have to find the most sensible way of estimating.
Yeah, and that so, can't be a blocker to the claim simply because the defendant says, well, there isn't enough information to deal with it.
Or the data's too old.
Yeah, all of the other. And it's been good in back to Trains again with the Court of Appeal, that the challenge based on trying to look at liability and causation and say, well, you can't deal with those on an aggregate basis, which really would have been the death knell to a lot of claims under the regime. But again, the Court of Appeal being very firm and saying, no, we have to be very purposeful and practical about this, and we're going to be prepared to look at these issues of liability and causation on an aggregate basis. And I think that does really lead us to a very workable regime.
Very good. And on that note then, let's take a little bit of time to talk about the tactics that defendants are taking at certification, because I mean, it's been a moving picture, I think it's fair to say. We started off with Scooters, the first case, and then Merrick's, which of course wasn't certified first time around. And as we've said, that went all the way to the Supreme Court, where we've got the seminal judgment now on and the standard at certification. As you said, Nicola, there were plenty of challenges early on in relation to funding and insurance, but these seem to have smoothed out now. But I think as a result of Merrick's, Anthony, what you saw was, because Merrick's were saying there is no merits test, you saw some defendants trying to get a merits test into certification through the back door.
Yeah, well, I think you could see post-Merrick's that the two routes the defendants were either going to be going for strikeout, getting merits in, or going on the opt-out, opt-in route, again, trying to get merits in through the back door. And that's exactly what we've seen in the challenges since Merrick's. So that's where we are. I mean, the good thing about that is, I think, again, both the CAT and the appellate courts have been pretty robust in the way they approach that and those attempts to strike out claims, and those attempts to generally say, well, you know, this has to be opt-in, it can't be opt-out, have generally failed, with FX perhaps being the exception to that.
Yeah.
David, that's probably a good, point to turn to you on FX. Do you want to talk to us? Because I think on that one, we mustn't forget that the tribunal has a right to strike these claims out itself. In FX, it chose not to do so.
It chose not to do so, but of course it was a major part of the judgment in FX. And so I guess FX is a caveat to this otherwise very stimulating discussion about the pragmatism of the tribunal and approaching these things, because in FX the tribunal was concerned about the strength of the claims. And as you say, it did consider whether or not the claims should be struck out. It decided they shouldn't be, but it certainly felt they were capable of being struck out. And I think it's fair to say it was prompted to do so by the banks in their response to the claims, because they didn't oppose certification per se, but their strategy was to say the claim should be opt-in. And you can see why they did it, because FX is the first collective where the majority of the class are businesses or organisations as opposed to consumers. So of course the banks were saying it's a very different type of class, they're more sophisticated, they have larger individual claims. And they also said that the claims were ambitious, that the case on causation, so asserting market-wide harm based on the misconduct that the traders and banks were involved in, they said this it wasn't a strongly pleaded case. And the tribunal ran with that, and we can come on to the discussions about the practicability of opt-in, but on the strength of the claim, they certainly felt that the claims as currently pleaded are capable of being struck out. And that's one of the points which is going on appeal, because we got the certification judgment in March, and we now have a reasoned order from the tribunal granting us permission to appeal the judgment. So one of the points that we will be looking to explore with the Court of Appeal is whether the tribunal was right to impose what we consider to be an unduly harsh standard to pleadings at this early stage in the claim. And you've got to remember that we have no disclosure from the banks, right? So the classic information asymmetry points, I would say, apply here. You know, we have copies of the decisions, but that's it. And, you know, it's contemplated that we're going to be seeking disclosure of things like the chat room transcripts from the traders and obviously data from the banks. And you know, in the meantime, we've pleaded a very detailed case on causation by reference to very detailed expert evidence. We say that's sufficient at this early stage of the claim. Of course, we're going to be looking to refine as needed when we get disclosure, but the tribunal shouldn't be stifling the claim by placing an unduly harsh standard.
Yeah, that makes, I want to come back to disclosure and also to opt in. Opt out, but just to finish off on the tactics that defendants are taking at certification, because I think one of the most interesting things we've seen latterly is, as I said at the start, we had fierce opposition to certification strikeout applications, but most recently in the Google Play Store claim, we saw the defendant not opposing certification. Then the Apple App Store claim, we had a certification decision on the spot. So it does seem that there's an evolving picture when it comes to defendants' tactics.
And I think that's going to, for generally for consumer claims, I think that's going to be the future, is you won't see opposition in the same way you have. Credible consumer claims, I think, won't be opposed and will be certified.
Yeah, because you've seen a lot of costs being spent and the defendants having had to pay those costs at an early stage.
Yeah.
And I think now, having seen the direction of travel, we should hopefully see those moving much more quickly.
And fewer appeals as well, presumably. I think some of the most recent decisions haven't been appealed, which is a good thing, of course, for the claims being able to move forward. So key areas of battle still, or somewhere the picture is slightly less clear, there are areas in dispute. David, chief amongst those is this question of opt-in, opt-out, because as you were saying, we've got the tribunal's judgment in FX, but I think it's relatively fair to contrast that with the Court of Appeal's judgment in BT in at least some respects.
Absolutely. Well, it's a really interesting question. What is the role of opt-in claims in the collective regime here? Because the claims that have been advanced to date have all been, with one exception, of course, have been opt-outs. And, you know, there's a lot of sense in that, because in these sorts of cases, they're extremely expensive, you know, very large classes, some of them very diverse classes as well. And FX, of course, as I said, you know, it's not a consumer claim in the sense of, you know, private individuals. The majority of the class members are businesses or organisations. But the same concepts, you know, the same reasoning as to why consumers wouldn't pursue their own claims, I think applies to organisations. You know, there's a proportionality point. So let's just say an organisation has a claim of, say, £5,000. Now, for a consumer, that could be a lot of money. But if you're a business, when you're contemplating participating in, you know, complicated litigation in which you might need to give disclosure, in which you need to allocate someone to look at the case and talk to the lawyers, you might need to stand up to funding arrangements. It looks and smells like litigation from your perspective. It's a hassle. Mm. And if the benefit is, well, you might get £5,000 or so, or you might get a lot less, or you might get nothing, I think a lot of businesses, they're just not going to be interested. So this idea that, you know, a sophistication test being applied to decide whether or not these people want to participate misses that cost-benefit analysis that any rational organisation is going to take. So I think FX is going to be a really interesting case and appeal because, you know, if we're right that, you know, this is a case which should be an opt-out case, then obviously that, you know, I think clarifies what the purpose of the regime is. It isn't just for consumers. This is for any class of affected businesses, organisations, consumers who should have the right to vindicate, you know, and recover compensation.
Yeah. I mean, people certainly lose this point. I mean, this regime wasn't brought in for consumers or a distinction between consumers and businesses. I mean, the whole consultation process, the legislation, doesn't make any distinction between the two, but the courts haven't yet really grappled, I don't think, with this question.
And what it was seeking to do was find a route for those claims that weren't being brought. Mm. And if you think back with the absence, perhaps, of interchange, where we have seen a very large number of claims brought, which were all quite high value, you haven't seen the smaller companies or, you know, the smaller claims being brought because they're not, as you say, it's not practical. Yeah. Mm. And so I think it's to provide that mechanism for to make it more efficient. And so I think it's perhaps no surprise that the opt-out claims are leading the way because the opt-in is more similar to the type of group claim which people had available already.
Mm-hmm. And we have seen attempts, haven't we, in the you know, in the McLaren Roro case by defendants to carve out large corporates from the class unsuccessfully. You know, they that's moving forward as an opt-out class. There was a further area I wanted to touch on, Nicola, is this point about conflicts within a class, or at least potential conflicts. So that came up in the RHA's trucks claim.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I think within that class they had there's obviously newly purchased trucks and second-hand trucks. And so there is a point raised whether within that class you may have someone claiming for the same truck at different stages. Mm. And the way they've resolved it now is to say that is not an issue in an opt-in scenario because those people are choosing to accept that it's part of the same adjudication process and will be dealt with expert evidence in due course. I think one of the things that really drove that, as I understand it, is that some of the claimants were in both categories. Mm. So it was sort of accepted that there's not necessarily a clear line.
Yeah.
We were yet to see whether that will continue to be the case or whether you might see perhaps two class reps working together, representing different parts in the supply chain, but accepting that it's still a sensible way to amalgamate the claims.
Mm-hmm. But still, I think, an area where there's a bit of lack of clarity. The last area I thought it fit to mention in terms of a slight lack of clarity, David, was on carriage. We don't have a great deal on that yet.
Well, no, of course, FX carriage was a major part of the case because, of course, we had our application, Mr. Evans' application, and then, of course, you had the Higgins application and the tribunal case managed them together. So, you know, we had a CPO hearing in which both applications were considered in detail. So it's a very heavy case, a lot of evidence, a lot of submissions, specifically on carriage. And that's one of the points that's going to go on appeal, because the tribunal's granted both us and O'Higgins the right to appeal on all grounds, and one of the points that's being challenged is the tribunal's decision on carriage, in which it favoured Mr. Evans' application over that of Higgins. Mm-hmm. But you're right, carriage is definitely going to be a major feature of the regime. Yeah. You know, looking ahead, there's going to be a lot more applications coming up in the next 12 to 18 months, and I guarantee there's going to be more carriage issues. And it's something which I think, you know, you're looking at the experience in FX, it was very expensive, very time consuming, quite an invasive process. And I think, you know, we want to see a strong regime which grapples with these sorts of issues at an early stage and tries to find ways, where possible, to limit costs, you know, limit that sort of front loading of efforts that otherwise you get when you have these very big contests between very well resourced teams.
Yeah. And we're sort of, I mean, it's a great segue, David, because I think the final thing we wanted to talk about is the future. So there have been plenty of these claims filed, as we've been saying, and plenty now are moving past certification. The demand, Nicola, I think, on the tribunal's resources is quite significant.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because not only did we have all the stayed claims that have been sitting there waiting to start moving after Merricks, which meant we've got a lot of claims at the same stage of proceedings. But as you say, the volume of claims that are now being issued as the parameters are becoming clarified, I think it's fair to say there is a struggle for time in the tribunal's diary at the moment, and hopefully we'll find some way that that's not going to stymie the claims and delay them too much, because consumers, obviously, whilst we found all these legal intricacies and appeals very interesting, consumers don't quite understand why they still haven't got their money from claims that were issued 5 years ago. So I think, you know, it's been recognised in BT, for example, that is one that needs to be fast tracked, and that you've got some sort of elderly vulnerable consumers. So, yeah, hopefully I think it's going to be challenging, but we'll find a way of avoiding too much delay.
Mm-hmm. And as you were saying, David, in relation to disclosure, that, I mean, these claims, they have to be managed, don't they, in a proportionate and an efficient way. That's going to be really key.
Absolutely, because disclosure is obviously the most expensive and difficult part of any piece of litigation before you get to trial. And these claims, you know, some of them are gargantuan in scale. You've got enormous budgets. And of course, you've got defendants who are very motivated to try to run arguments, you know, to find ways to delay these sorts of things. And as Nicola says, when you're running a claim on behalf of perhaps a vulnerable category of consumers, you know, the idea that this could take up to, you know, 7 or 8 years or something, I mean, that's hopeless, isn't it? So you want to try to find a way, especially when you have a top-down methodology for assessing harm, to approach disclosure in a reasonable and proportionate way and to wield the axe effectively and to not let data be your enemy.
But this is an area, I've said this before, this is an area that's a huge chasm of understanding between defendants and claimants. When you say to defendants, you ain't going to get any class disclosure, and they fall off their chairs. So this is definitely an area of conflict where defendants are going to be trying to push for some form of class disclosure and claimants are going to be resisting it. And I think that is definitely going to be something we think developed over the next few months.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to have this, I mean, we'll see how this new, the procedural innovation that is umbrella proceedings orders plays out. So this is the mechanism by which we see claims, the group claims being managed alongside collectives in theory. But I think it's fair to say that some, well, that has yet to work itself through.
Yeah, and you can see what the tribunal's trying to do is grapple with how do they deal with these multiplicity of claims, and also with some judicial consistency, because it is right that you would expect or hope that in a regime where the same cartel claims are being brought, you see some consistency of decision. And I think this stemmed obviously from interchange, where we had three trials coming to different results. And those claims, a lot of them are still continuing. So I think that the idea of saying, okay, if we have corporate claims and consumer claims, should they be joined together? There's some sense in trying to manage them, but equally there's going to be some frustration along the way, I think, of people, you know, bringing individual claims that feel they're entitled to progress those, and ideally not be, you know, tied in with a consumer claim. So I think, again, there's going to be quite a lot of case management decisions coming up as we work through those.
And Anthony, the final word, any sort of horizon scanning as to the future would be incomplete without a reference to settlements. We haven't seen any yet,
No, you've got to think at some point someone's going to settle one of these things, right? But there are obviously a lot of questions around quite how you do that. You know, how does the cat approach it? How do you notice it? How do you distribute it, etc.? So a lot of uncharted territory there.
Mm-hmm.
But once these things start to get certified, a compelling logic on defendants to see if they can settle them, because there are compelling economic incentives to do so.
There's quite a lot of uncertainty for a defendant at this point of knowing how that process is going to work, and it obviously is very public. So it's not sort of the taking the issue away quietly behind the scenes that they may be used to. So,
but you have the interest there in terms of the, you know, the possibility of reversion.
I'd love to be a fly on the wall in some of these defendant meetings if they're talking about settlement.
They're going to invite you.
Sadly not. A bit optimistic, maybe. Okay, I think we should call it a day there. There's plenty more that we could say, I'm sure, about the future of the regime in particular, but we'll call it an end there. So thank you, Anthony, Nicola, and David.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks.
Thank you.